Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
On her first trip to study wild chimpanzees in what today is Tanzania, primatologist Jane Goodall brought along a tent, some cooking equipment, a cheap pair of binoculars, and her mom. She didn't even have a bachelor's degree yet in science, but she did possess extraordinary patience, curiosity, and drive. And that combination allowed her to recognize what generations of better credentialed scientists had overlooked. Chimpanzees ate meat, used tools, and indeed made tools out of materials at hand. Her observations forever changed human understanding of our closest primate relatives. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, just a few days shy of her 82nd birthday, Goodall leaves field research to others and who have followed in her footsteps, but she remains devoted to the cause of education and environmental stewardship and still spends up to 300 days a year touring the world to share her passion for conservation. Today, that advocacy brings her to North Texas. She's in town to speak tonight to the Maverick Speaker Series at the University of Texas at Arlington, and we are delighted she could make time for us today. Jane, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you.
Did you grow up with animals around the house?
We always had a dog, and then I got a couple of guinea pigs and a hamster, you know, the usual things. And I had a very, very supportive mother, and I really think that's the key to just about everything. And, you know, I was fascinated by animals even before I could walk, apparently.
Did you have a picture in your mind of Africa? I mean, you must have before you went there for the first time. I wonder how different it was when you actually arrived.
Well, my pictures came mostly originally from Dr. Doolittle, who took circus animals back to Africa. And then along came Tarzan when I was 10 years old. And I read that book so many times and fell passionately in love with Tarzan. And then he went and married the wrong Jane, which was frustrating. But my idea of Africa, yes, it was wasn't that much different. It's very different now. But when I first went, it was still sort of the tail end of the colonial days and lots of animals everywhere.
How did you come to be interested specifically in African wildlife? You could have gone to many parts of the world to look at wildlife. Was it because of that exposure to literature when you were a kid?
It was Tarzan, yeah. And I was, a realist, and I knew I might never get to Africa. It was very, very far away in those days. There were no planes going back and forth, no real tourism. And I thought about Canada because I loved the idea of bears and wolves. And I thought a little bit about the wild jungles of South America. But Africa came first.
So you cold called Louis Leakey.
Well, it happened because a school friend of mine, her parents moved to Kenya. And she wrote and invited me to stay. That was the opportunity that my mother told me I had to look for. And so I saved up the money by working as a waitress in a hotel. And it took about 5 months. And then off I went, and I stayed with my friend. I got a job. And then I heard about Louis Leakey. Somebody said, if you're interested in animals, you should meet Louis. So, yes, I did. I called him and arranged to meet him, just to meet him and talk about animals and see what opportunities there might be. And I left with a job as a sort of secretary assistant.
What did he want you to observe, to note, and to send back to him? What kind of information was he interested in?
Just about anything, because we didn't know anything about the chimpanzees back then. And so just watch and write. There was no more instructions than that.
I've been thinking about you in preparing for this interview, just that patience to watch for a long time, over days and weeks and months and years. That seems really extraordinary to us today when we have devices in our palms all the time and we, you know, can't really stand to be left alone without a lot of different sources of information pulsing at us.
I grew up in a very different world. You know, there was no television when I was a child. It was books. There was radio and listening to people. And I'd always loved being alone. I used to spend hours and hours up my favorite tree in the garden when I was a child. And I think patience was born into me. You know, there's the story of my hiding in a hen house to see how a hen laid an egg. And apparently, although I was only 4 years old, I was there over 4 hours.
Hmm.
And so I was born that way.
So when you got to Gombe Stream National Park, the first thing you had to do was find some chimpanzees. But how did you set about looking for them?
It did seem a little daunting. But the first couple of days I was made to go out with the game scout. And so he took me up to a high place from where we could see over a valley, because the people knew that there was a fruiting tree and the chimps might come to it. But it was quite far away. And the biggest problem in those days was they wouldn't let me get anywhere near them. They were afraid. And so very quickly I was able to persuade the authorities that I could be on my own, which of course made it, the chimps got used to me more quickly. It was just me.
How did you establish your presence with them so that they wouldn't be frightened, wouldn't feel aggressive? What did it take for you before you knew anything about these animals to form a relationship?
Just instinct. So it was wearing the same colored clothes every day, not trying to get too close too quickly. And as they gradually allowed me to get closer, to start with, I never tried to follow them. I thought, you know, let them feel that I'm just very non-threatening. And it was really one chimpanzee, David Greybeard, who lost his fear before the others for reasons we don't know, but they're all different, just like we are.
He seems to have been just such an extraordinary creature. Can you tell people about him who haven't read about him?
He was a very gentle chimpanzee. He wasn't aggressive with the others. In fact, if the young ones were in trouble, they often ran to David and he would embrace them. He was extremely handsome, one of the most handsome chimps I've ever known at Gombe. Had this lovely white beard. And he was a leader. So that doesn't mean he was the top-ranking male. There's a big difference between being a leader and being the number one alpha, you know, who everyone submits to. So not everyone submitted to David, but if he set off on a particular journey to a particular food, very often others would follow.
What is it like to look into a chimp's eyes? Like, what kind of recognition do you see? And can you also recognize the things that this other creature doesn't understand?
I think, you know, when I look into a chimpanzee's eyes, and you can, if you look a gorilla in the eye, it's a sign of aggression. And if you look in a chimp's eyes in a certain way, it can be aggression. But you learn to look in a way that's asking from them and not pushing into them. And I think when I look into a chimpanzee's eyes like that, you know, the thing that always comes into my mind is, I just wish that I could look out with his eyes, see the world as he sees it, and I never can. We're so alike. We share emotions. We communicate in many of the same ways, like kissing, embracing, holding hands. But yet there's this difference because they can't actually talk to us.
How do they communicate with one another?
I wasn't really trying to communicate anything except a sense of trust, that they should trust me. I didn't want to communicate with them. I mean, Diane Fossey used to make gorilla sounds to the gorillas when she sat in the alpha male's lap and things like that. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to intervene into their life. And for a while, much later, we set up a feeding station because my husband, who became my husband, Hugo van Lauwek, sent by the National Geographic to get film. He was desperate to get film, so luring them with bananas. But apart from that, we don't do that anymore.
When you see them communicating with one another, though, is it mostly physical? How much do they use vocalization to try to communicate things to one another?
When it's close up, they do have sounds that they make. And they all mean different things. But really, the most important communication, if you're close to another chimpanzee, is gestures and postures and touch. Those are all very important. You know, they have the same begging gesture as we do, reaching out a hand, palm up. And then if there's an aggressive element, it's swaggering, bristling the hair, bunching the lips in a furious scowl. If they spy something on the other side of the valley, they may look and then look back at the, they want somebody to come with them, look up again, touch, and these are the ways they communicate.
Can you talk a little bit about your emotion when you realized, and you've written about this, that they weren't necessarily always benign, they could be violent with one another, even cannibalistic. It sounds like it was almost a mourning process to deal with that after you realized that it was true.
It was a shock. The first time, I didn't actually see the first time it happened, but when males are, we find they're very territorial, and in groups of three or more, the males of a community will patrol the territory. And if they spy an individual from the neighboring social group, then that's when they will try and incite the others to follow them. Usually the females drop back if they're in the group. And the attacks are vicious and brutal, and the victim will die. The attacks are so violent. And it was a real shock, because I thought they were like us, but nicer.
How much of chimp behavior is dictated by the local culture?
Quite a bit. We know for sure that now that there are other study sites around Africa, that there are different tool-using behaviors, for example, and the young ones watch, they then imitate, and they practice. In some cases, like in West Africa, they're using rocks to hammer open hard-shelled fruit, and that's very difficult for the young ones to do. So our chimps mostly use sticks and twigs to fish insects from their holes or leaves to wipe themselves. But every single place, there are differences. And as it's clearly behavior passed from one generation to the next through observation and learning, that is a definition of human culture.
That was devastating for people who had said that only humans did that sort of thing when you first discovered
it. Yes, I know. It was we were defined as man the toolmaker. And so when I sent Leakey a telegram, he sent a telegram back and said, we shall have to redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans. And a lot of people didn't believe me. Some people actually thought I taught the chimps. Well, that would have been a real, I was still not able to get close to them. So it would have been very amazing if I'd managed to teach them something.
Did you ultimately have to document it with film to convince people who thought that you were not telling the truth?
Still photos. Mm-hmm. The first person to take still photos of chimps using a tool was my sister. And she came out to take photos because I didn't want anybody who looked less like me. I mean, she sounds like me and she very much like me in many ways. And I thought that won't be frightening to the chimps.
What kind of guidance did you give people like your sister who were coming for the first time? What did you say about what to do and what not to do?
Same as what I did. Just be calm. No rapid movements. Don't push them. You know, be respectful. I think respect is an important word.
You think they can sense that?
I'm sure they can. Quite sure they can. I mean, animals, we just haven't given them credit for all the powers that they have, all the things they can do. And every time something crops up, like, you know, the octopus. Have you seen the octopus who takes two empty coconut shells?
Right, right.
And then makes them into a house. Oh, people are so amazed. Well, every time something like that hits the news, everybody says, how amazing. And it's just because we haven't used our eyes, we haven't been prepared to admit how intelligent these other beings with whom we share the planet are.
We're speaking this hour with primatologist and conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for THINK comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
Mm-hmm. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with primatologist, conservationist, and author Jane Goodall. She's in town to speak to the Maverick Speaker Series at the University of Texas at Arlington tonight. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. How did you deal with the fact, Jane, that you were physically vulnerable when you were close to chimps, even the ones that you trusted could have hurt you if they had chosen to?
I don't know that I can answer that. I was there, and yes, they could have hurt me, and sometimes they did, actually. You know, we have one, had one. Sadly, he's dead now, but he was the biggest we've ever had. He's bully to all the other chimps, and he often knocked people over just in passing. And for me, he had a special, I don't know, but he would come way out of his way to charge at me and knock me over. And at the time, he was sort of angry in a way. And afterwards, then you're shaking a bit because they are so strong.
How do you not take that personally?
I think I did take it personally, quite honestly, because it was very definite that I knew he was coming, and I knew he was in a bad mood, and they'd been fighting. So I went way up this hillside, I mean, really high. And he came along, and he was on his own. He was obviously in a bad mood, and he's walking along the trail. And he looked up, he saw me, he came all the way up in order to charge at me and knock me over. So I did take it personally, and I was always willing him to understand, Frodo, I know you're dominant. I totally am submissive to you. Do not need to prove it again. He wasn't trying to hurt or kill because he could have done it so easily.
He wanted to demonstrate to you that he was the top dog.
Yes, and it wasn't necessary at all.
Lest people think that this was mostly an idyllic experience, humans made it dangerous for you and your companions at Gombe.
Yes, we had a kidnapping. And that was really a terrible thing to go through. Four of my students, which was later when I'd built up a research station, they were kidnapped in the middle of the night and taken over to what is now DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. But we didn't know where they'd gone. We didn't know where the people came from. And it was a nightmare time when, fortunately, they all came back. Ransom was paid.
Do you feel like there's anything about your observation of other primates that has given you particular insight into human behavior?
I think it's pretty obvious that the aggression, which sadly we're seeing more and more around the world, there is some kind of innate aggressive tendency, which is very easily provoked by different circumstances. And when people say, oh, well, that means war and violence are inevitable, I say no, because we have developed this extraordinary intellect. So more than any other animal, I think, we can, if we wish, control our basic aggressive instincts. And then on top of those instincts, we have fighting for power, fighting for money. You get your religious strife. So that's all superimposed on an underlying aggressive instinct, I think.
Have you observed anything among chimpanzees that resembles morality?
They definitely can show altruistic behavior. So an infant who's lost his mother, if he has an older brother or sister, including a brother, brothers make very good caretakers, and they will adopt a child and care for him, and possibly his life will be saved, as long as he's more or she is more than 3 years old, because up to 3 years they totally rely on their mother's milk. It's a very long childhood, we believe, because there's so much for them to learn, like our children. And even a chimpanzee who's not related to an orphan may adopt that child. It's been seen in several places. But by and large, if there's a fight, they're very good at reconciliation, but it's going to be the victim who makes that reconciliation and goes up and shows submissive behavior, even if they weren't in the wrong, so to speak. So might is right in a way.
How has Tanzania changed since you first began your research there? How has the climate changed life in Tanzania?
You mean climate change?
Yeah.
I think, you know, the biggest change is political, because when I arrived, it was still part of the crumbling British Empire. It was the British Protectorate. And then we had independence. And so huge, huge changes. Forests have disappeared and animal numbers have dropped way down. And, you know, it's very different from when I arrived. And climate change is having a huge effect on some parts where they get longer droughts. Then when it does rain, it rains too much and there's flooding. And it's causing some strange things that you wouldn't think about. For example, around Arusha in Tanzania, the farmers in the outlying villages used to bring their produce into market on motorbikes. But now it's either too skiddy or too slippery and they've turned to donkeys. So this means there's terrible cruelty to donkeys. So with our youth program, we're trying to address that issue. So it strikes in surprising ways that you can't possibly always predict, but definitely drought's getting worse in sub-Saharan Africa. And the other huge change is the increase in poaching, wildlife trafficking, the terrible ivory and rhino horn situation.
I know that you have confronted the fact that there are people trying to subsist and who see for themselves the only path to that as being things that are bad for the environment, bad for animals. Talk about reconciling the need to take care of human beings and the need to take care of the environment. And is it ever impossible to find a middle path?
It was when I flew over the whole of the Gombe area in the early 90s in a small plane. You know, I knew there was deforestation outside the park, but when I flew over totally bare hills with a little oasis of forest that was Gombe, and it was clear there were more people living there than the land could support, population growth had occurred there like everywhere else around the world, soil was over-farmed, infertile, there was terrible erosion, and people were struggling to survive. And that's when I realized if we don't work to improve the lives of the people, then we can never even hope to save or even try to save the Gombe chimpanzees. So that led to the Jane Goodall Institute program. We call it Take Care or Tukari. And it's a very holistic program addressing the needs of the people. I think one of the most important components has been microcredit, particularly groups of women, so they can choose small environmentally sustainable projects and take out a loan. Almost all of it's paid back. And as their lives improve and we help them to find alternative ways of living without destroying the forest, now they've turned around and they're actually helping to protect the forest and the chimpanzees.
Do the local residents have a sort of fondness for the chimpanzees?
They had a lot of superstitious beliefs about them. And in some places they believe that, it's a very funny belief, but they believe that when there's a solar eclipse, if you're caught outside, then you'll turn into a chimpanzee. So when there's an eclipse, everybody runs for cover.
Is education part of the effort to make people's lives better?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just in Africa. It's everywhere, all around the world. And, of course, if you're starving, you cut down the last trees to grow more food or to sell for charcoal. So we just have to alleviate this crippling poverty. And it's the same in an urban area. People buy the cheapest food, cheapest clothing, because they have to. And they can't afford to think about where was it made, did it damage the environment, did it result in human suffering or animal suffering. They just have to buy the cheapest. So poverty is a huge underlying factor of all that's wrong with the world today.
You've described your pivot from research to conservation as kind of a Damascus moment. Mm-hmm. What happened?
There was a conference in 1986 in Chicago, and it was really to honor. I just put 25 years of research into this big book, Gombe Chimpanzees, Patterns of Behavior. It was meant to be volume one. And so we had this conference in Chicago put on by the Chicago Academy of Sciences, and we brought in all just the chimp people. They first said, oh, let's have gorillas and orangutans. Let's just have chimps.
And is there a lot of territorialism between, like, the gorilla people
well,
and the two people?
Competition for funds, I suppose. And, you know, my animal's smarter than your species. But anyway, we had just chimps and bonobos. Mm-hmm. And that was the conference where it was actually me. I said, look, bonobos are not pygmy chimpanzees. They're completely different. And they are. So that's when bonobo became the accepted word. But anyway, there were about 8 study sites at that time. And it was shocking. We had a session on conservation everywhere. Forest going, the beginning of the bushmeat trade, the commercial hunting of wild animals for food and snares, deforestation. We had a session on conditions in captivity. And I can never forget secretly filmed video of chimpanzees, our closest relatives, who can live more than 60 years, confined in 5-foot by 5-foot steel cages alone. It was so shocking to me. So I'm not conscious of any decision. And I call it the Damascus moment because St. Paul was just going along the road and whatever happened. Some people say it was an epileptic fit. But when he came out of whatever it was, you know, he was then set out on a different course. Same for me. I went there as a scientist. I had a fabulous life. Time to be in the field with the chimps. I could have time for writing books, analyzing data, doing some teaching at Stanford University. Had a child. It was just perfect. Had the research station, and I left as an activist. I honestly didn't make the decision.
Does it feel like a sacrifice to be away from the field, away from teaching, to do this kind of activism?
Well, it's a sacrifice in a way. I mean, I hate all the traveling. And I just, but knowing what I know, I could not go back to the other life. I couldn't do it. Then I would be unhappy.
Talk about animals in captivity. A lot of people are starting to question whether we should have zoos, even well-maintained zoos, because they are unnatural environments. Other people maintain that these are great ways to educate people and maybe, you know, grow a sense of responsibility. What do you think about this?
I think that a really good zoo is able to give many animals a pretty good life. There's also this fallacy, this way of thinking that wild is best. Well, I know for a fact that in so many places in the, in quotes, wild, the animals are having a life of terror. They're being poached, they're being caught in snares, they're being hunted, they're being shot. That's including in the United States, you know. And so a really good zoo for some creatures, I think they can have an okay life. And I think for a child, yes, there's great television. You can look at every detail of an animal's life, but that's very different for a small child, I think, than standing in the presence of one of these amazing beings, having the sense of their beingness and smelling them and looking into their eyes. That's something you can't get from television. But the bad zoos, and there's way too many, usually because they don't have enough money, but some parts of the world because they don't understand, they should all be closed.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jane Goodall. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Logan, who says, I was just wondering how, after observing chimpanzees for hours, days, and weeks on end, your mind can remain fresh. So when you see an action or characteristic, you're able to tell whether this is an actual action or characteristic of the chimpanzee versus something your mind wants to see.
I don't think I've ever been tempted to think, oh, my mind would like to see this. There are times when you're trying to understand a certain behavior and you think, that's what it means. And then something happens and you think, bother, my theory is completely wrong, and you have to start all over again. And the temptation there, I never succumbed to it, but nobody knew I saw that other little thing which made my theory collapse, so I needn't have said anything about it. But that is so dishonest.
How do you decide, you know, you mentioned that when a chimp wants something, it'll put its hand out with palm up, and that's very similar to the gesture that any human would recognize. There must be some things that are very different. How much can you apply what you know about human nature when you're watching a primate?
An awful lot. And, you know, really when push comes to shove, the big, big difference, I think, is this explosive development of our intellect, which I think the fact that at some point in our evolution we developed this amazing way of communicating that you and I are using now, Chris, that people over from miles away can listen and hear us because of the development of technology. And I think that when we learn to speak, something happened, because now I can tell you and all these other people about things you may never have seen. And if I use words in the right way, can bring a picture into your mind. We can have discussions. We can bring people in with different experience to try and solve a problem. We can teach our children about things that aren't present. We can plan for the distant future. And those possibilities, I think, is what pushed our intellect. So that although chimps and other animals are way more intelligent than people have given them credit for, and in ways which we're still finding out, there's an awful lot to learn. But the kind of mind that can send a rocket up to Mars, from which a little robot creeps that takes photos of the red planet, our mind is so different from that of any other animal.
Can you imagine what existence would be like if there were, say, two species of highly intelligent beings simultaneously?
I think that's what happened. I think that's why, you know, Louis Leakey spent his life searching for the fossilized remains of early humans. And it turns out that the human evolutionary line, you know, there were all kinds of presumably intelligent creatures that developed and disappeared. And the theory goes that the ones who were just a little bit more intelligent wiped out the others, competition for food or something like that. We don't know.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jane Goodall. She's a conservationist, primatologist, and author in town to speak tonight to the Maverick Speaker Series at the University of Texas at Arlington. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with primatologist Dr. Jane Goodall, who's in town to speak tonight to the Maverick Speaker Series at the University of Texas at Arlington. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. During the break, I showed you a photograph of a little girl who did a school project about you as her hero. It was a women's history project. And Maggie, the girl, is in third grade and wants to know what an 8-year-old girl can do to help protect animals.
Ah, what she can do is to join the Jane Goodall Institute Roots and Shoots program. And this is a program for young people of all ages. We even have preschoolers, but very strong in kindergarten and very strong in university and everything in between. And it began with 12 high school students in Tanzania in 91, and it's now in 140 countries. We've got about 100,000 active groups. And the main message is each one of us makes a difference every day with the little choices we make, what we do, what we buy, what we eat, what we wear. And every group themselves choose 3 projects to make the world better, one to help people, one to help other animals, and one to help the environment.
Where did the name come from, Roots and Shoots?
Because if you think of your favorite big tree and then think how it began as a little seed, you can pick it up when it starts to grow and it'll have small roots and a little shoot. And it seems so weak, But there's a magic, a life force in that seed that's so powerful that those little roots to reach the water can work through rocks and eventually push them aside, and that little shoot to reach the sun can work its way through concrete and eventually knock it down. So if you think of the rocks and the concrete as all the problems we have inflicted on the planet, environmental and social, then it's hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can break through and make this a better world for all living things.
If humans evolved to be omnivores, why should we choose not to eat meat today?
There's a lot of reasons for not eating meat. One is the very often, sadly, horrific cruelty that's involved when you get industrial animal farming. And I think if people could see what goes on in these factory farms, I can't imagine anybody would even want to think about eating meat again. But there's another reason, too, to feed them. Huge areas of forest are cut down every year to grow the grain. That's releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the main greenhouse gas. It's very intensive use of water to turn vegetable protein into animal protein. It's using huge amounts of fossil fuel, driving the animals, driving the meat, whatever. And there's another thing, too, and that is that food goes in one end and gas comes out the other. For all of us, we do it, too. And so that gas is methane, and that's an even more virulent greenhouse gas than CO2. And so for all of these reasons, I mean, for me, it was the cruelty. And after I learned about intensive farms, I looked at a piece of meat on my plate and I thought, huh, this symbolizes fear, pain, death. I don't want to eat that.
When was that?
That was about the end of the 60s when I read Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. I didn't know about factory farms before that. We didn't have them.
When you move through the world, I would imagine you get recognized like a rock star. And you're shaking your head with a little bit of ruefulness in your eyes. It can't be easy. You didn't set out to be famous.
I can't walk through an airport. And, you know, you get off a plane, you're feeling at your worst. You're exhausted. You haven't slept. Your hair's a mess. You're all wrunkled and crumpled. And somebody comes up and says, oh, you're Jane Goodall, and they're from Japan, or they're from China, or they're from Latin America, or they're Americans, or the Europeans. It doesn't matter. And can I have a photo? And I'm thinking, oh, crikey. So I always give them a little postcard with the Jane Goodall Institute on it, tell them about roots and shoots. You know, we have to pay somehow for this photo.
How do you? How many of those experiences do you imagine you've had since 1986?
I couldn't begin to count. Millions. I mean, literally millions. Think how many airports I go through, or walking along the street, or, I mean, when I went to South Korea for the first time, I was walking with a professor along a riverbank in the evening, and this young man came rushing up and said, oh, you're Jane Goodall. And I'm thinking, I just don't believe it.
When you have time to yourself, what do you do with it?
If I'm at home in England, and it's the house I grew up in where my sister lives, so that's got all my childhood books, you know, my roots are there. There's always dogs. So every day I take the dogs out. That's something I love to do. And all the rest of the time, writing. I love writing. And on this traveling craziness, I don't have time to write.
So what makes you continue traveling? Is it that being somewhere in person, does it have a different impact than publishing?
It does. People tell me. They say, you know, I've seen you on TV and read your books, but actually being here in person is a different feeling. It's rather like the animals in the zoo, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, I'm captive in a zoo without bars.
Do you watch people too?
Do I watch people all the time? I love watching people.
I'm interested that Louis Leakey chose Diane Fossey as well, and I'm going to say this wrong, but Brute Galdikas.
Galdikas.
All women. Maybe that's a coincidence, or maybe there was something he saw in women that drew him to think that, that you were the correct choices to study primates for
him?
He
felt women were better observers. And at the time, of course, everything was so different. There was no feminism abroad. And so you grew up and the things girls did, they became secretaries, nurses, cooks, something like that. There was no real careers. And you expected a white knight would come along and marry you and look after you for the rest of your life. That was the thinking, you know. So I think that we could afford to be more patient, whereas the man is the breadwinner and he's got to get out there and then he's got to write up his PhD so he can get a good job. At that time, that's how it was. But I do think that as a woman, we probably have some underlying characteristics that would be helpful. One, we're used to, if we're a mother, we've got to understand the wants and needs of a little primate before it can speak. So that could be helpful. We have to learn patience. You have to be patient to be a good mother. And I think traditionally in the family, the women are the ones who notice the uncle's in a really bad mood, so I must keep my child away from him while he's in that mood. So you learn to notice things. And also with the, you know, sadly, the traditional abuse of women, they had to be pretty clever to try and avoid that. Now, of course, I didn't experience that, but I know people who have.
Working with students and colleagues who were working under you over the years, did you find yourself dealing with the men and the women in different ways, or were there different things that you had to teach them?
No, I don't think so, because by and large, the men who came out as students have all the right characteristics. They're drawn to it because they are patient, and so there's no difference, really.
Do you believe there is life on other planets?
Life on another planet?
Mm-hmm.
I suspect so. I can't imagine why we would be the only planet to have life. It doesn't make sense.
Do you spend any time thinking about what it might look like?
No, because the life on our own planet is so varied. And there are creatures that do seem they've come from outer space, and we find, you know, they can live down without even any oxygen. So they've adapted just on this Earth to so many different ways of looking and behaving.
Yeah, are there some underwater creatures now that can live in ammonia or something?
Yes, all that
astonishing.
Yes, and in a petrol even, and some can live by eating plastic. I wish there were billions of them. Plastic is a scourge. Oh, it's terrible.
In the oceans, in
the
waterways.
Oceans and waterways, and the hedgerows where animals get stuck in these 6-can loops. Everybody should cut them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Mike who asks, what's the best way to change the minds of political leaders that science and critical thinking education is very important?
Stories. I think the only way you can change people's mind is by being very non-confrontational, very non-aggressive, and just thinking, you know, if you truly believe that some political leader or anybody has really wrong ideas because they haven't understood the facts, then how do you get the facts to them without sounding aggressive? It's usually by telling stories, I think.
It's interesting when you say that, because earlier you described approaching chimpanzees who didn't know you yet and making no sudden movements and making sure that they knew that they had nothing to fear from you. It sounds like a very similar strategy.
I think it's very similar. I think, you know, I was born with certain, I guess, gifts. One gift is a strong physique, which I inherited from my father. And the other is a gift to communicate. And that's nothing special that I can be proud of, but I was given it as a gift, so my job is to use it.
You are very strong. You're very healthy. Do you exercise in addition to the moving about the world that you do through your work?
No time. I can't do that. Even when I cracked did something to my shoulder, I was told, if you don't do exercise, if you don't have physiotherapy, you know, you'll never, ever be able to use your arm properly again. But I mean, I didn't have time for it.
You look like you're ready to go out and play tennis right now. Jane is moving her arm in every possible direction. to me, you are such a feminist and such a, you know, a symbol of the power of women. Do you think of yourself that way, or did there come a time when you thought, this is how I see the world?
No. And again, going back, it was to my upbringing, because when me and my sister were children, I don't think ever in my family was there anybody who said, you can't do that because you're a girl. They did say it at school, but your family, you're closer to. Well, we had very close relations with our family, and it was a family of strong women. My grandmother was the first, one of the very, very first women to go to this. They had she went and learned how to teach gym. And that was long before others. My aunt was one of the very first physiotherapists. So I had great models within my own family.
Who is doing research work today that you are really interested in following?
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, all the people who are working with animal minds, and animal personalities, all of this I find really, really fascinating. And then there's the research into the causes of and ways to cure climate change. You know, I mean, there's just so much out there. I just don't have time to do all the reading I would love to do.
I suppose you are wired to be optimistic, but I wonder if you believe we'll fix the climate before ultimately billions of people are negatively affected.
Only if we wake up. This is why I travel all this time. This is why I'm developing the youth program, because if our young people lose hope, we have no hope. But they are so energetic. They are doing so much. They are so positive. And wherever I go, I meet these students, and they're influencing their parents and their grandparents, and they're going out to be teachers and teach children. So we're creating a new youth who understand that while we need money to live, we shouldn't be living for money, and unless we're living for money to make the world better, and that we realize there's been a disconnect between this clever brain and the human heart, love and compassion, and that's causing us to make decisions and to follow technologies. I mean, look at the chemicals we spread on the agricultural land. They're poison. And it's proven so now, glyphosate, which is the main ingredient of Roundup Ready, the most frequently used herbicide. And that's poison. And genetically modified food, there's so much evidence out there that it's, in the long run, probably very bad for us.
Do you think that the chimpanzees of Gombe will survive?
I think they will. We've got now all the local people, they've put land aside between the Gombe Park and the village as a buffer zone, and creating a corridor of forest so that will link the Gombe chimps to the other chimps that we're also working to save, and that now there's hope. There wasn't hope because the Gombe chimps were isolated, but they're not anymore. We had two new females come in last year from somewhere else, genetically not related to the Gombe chimps at all, because we can test the DNA with fecal samples.
That is a strange place to leave, but we are out of time. My guest this hour was primatologist, conservationist, and author Jane Goodall. She'll speak tonight to the Maverick Speaker Series at the University of Texas at Arlington, and you can find a lot more about her work and her work with advocacy and education for children online. Jane, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.